You wouldn't know it was there if you weren't listening for it. In the deep stillness of a Jamaican night, the forest is a black sea of sound. The hiss of wind through leaves, the slow drip of water off a bromeliad, the rustle of something small moving over the forest floor. It's not a lizard, not a mongoose. The sound is heavier, measured, and deliberate. A beam of red-filtered light catches the curve of fur. Thick, brown, and coarse. Round ears twitch. Bright eyes freeze, weighing whether to bolt into the undergrowth or stay still. This is a Jamaican huisha, known locally as the coney. If you've never heard of it, you're not alone. Most Jamaicans have never seen one in the wild. Once, huishas roamed the whole island. They were a part of daily life for the first people here, a source of food, a presence in stories. Now they survive in only a handful of places. Scraps of wild forest spared from farming, quarrying, and roads. They move mostly at night, careful and quiet, avoiding the predators humans brought to their home. For scientists, finding one is like opening a door to Jamaica's distant past. For the people who live near them, it's a reminder that the island still keeps secrets. A living connection to the time before the first European ships touched the shore. And yet, this connection is slipping away. The Jamaican huisha is now endangered, its numbers low, its world shrinking. Saving it will mean understanding it. How it lives, where it hides, and what it needs to survive the century ahead. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1: In the Shadows of the Forest. The road into cockpit country ends in a patch of gravel and scrub grass. From here, there are no streetlights, no houses, no sound but the constant hum of crickets. The air is warm and still, with a faint smell of damp limestone and leaf mold. You shoulder your pack, switch on the red-filtered headlamp, and step into the dark. The forest here is not the kind you see in postcards. It's dense, layered, and unpredictable. The ground rises and falls without warning, the result of thousands of years of rain carving sinkholes and ridges into the limestone bedrock. In the narrow valleys between, the trees grow so close their branches knit together overhead. The night sky disappears. This is one of the last strongholds of the Jamaican huisha, Geocaprimes brownii, a stocky brown-furred rodent about the size of a small rabbit. Once, it ranged across the island. Now, it survives here, in these pockets of forest that humans have not yet cleared. No farms, no quarries, no highways. Just rock, soil, and tangled vegetation that's too steep or too stubborn for easy use. The huisha is nocturnal, which means this is the only time you'll see it active. During the day, it shelters in rocky crevices or burrows dug into soft soil under tree roots. At night, it comes out to feed on leaves, bark, fruits, and seeds. Its movements are quiet but deliberate, a series of short bursts followed by long pauses to listen for danger. Your guide tonight is Joseph Joey McCoy, a local forest warden who's been working in these hills for 25 years. He walks without a flashlight, his steps sure on the uneven ground. "You have to let your ears do the work," he says softly. "If you depend only on your eyes, you'll miss them. Listen for the scratch." We stop at the edge of a clearing where a few young guango trees are spaced far enough apart to let a little starlight through. The leaf litter here is thick, and there's a scattering of half-eaten guava on the ground. Joey points to a dark shape moving slowly near the base of a boulder. Even in the dim light, you can see the rounded back and the short, almost hidden tail. The huisha freezes, its small ears swiveling forward. For a moment, no one moves. The forest feels suspended, as if holding its breath. Then the animal lowers its head and resumes nibbling at the edge of a fallen leaf. Joey leans close. "That's a female," he whispers. "See the size? And she's alone. The males don't stay close unless it's breeding time." You make a note. Solitary, nocturnal, cautious. Traits that help explain how the species has managed to survive centuries of change on this island. The red light catches the texture of the fur, coarse, with a faint reddish-brown sheen. The huisha's eyes are black, glistening and alert. It chews slowly, pausing often to raise its head and scan the shadows. Every small sound, a twig snapping, a leaf falling, makes it freeze. We stay still, watching. Eventually, it moves toward a low tangle of vines and disappears into the undergrowth. The whole encounter lasts less than 2 minutes, but it feels longer, like stepping briefly into a hidden world. As we continue along the trail, Joey talks about the work of finding these animals. You can walk for hours and see nothing, he says. Sometimes I only know they're here, because I find the droppings or see the teeth marks on a branch. And even then, I can't be sure I'll ever lay eyes on them. The Jamaican huisha is not a rare species in the sense of being delicate. It's hardy. It can eat a wide variety of plants, dig into tough soil, and survive long dry spells. But its range is small now, and shrinking. And when a population gets too small, no matter how tough the animal is, it becomes vulnerable. We stop to check a motion-activated camera, strapped to a tree trunk. Joey opens the casing, pulls out the memory card, and slips it into a small tablet. On the screen, we watch a short clip. A huisha stepping into view, sniffing the ground, then vanishing as quickly as it appeared. The timestamp shows it was filmed just 2 nights ago. Sometimes the camera is the only way to keep track, Joey says. We can't be everywhere. And if we disturb them too much, we make their lives harder. The trail narrows, the limestone underfoot slick with moss. We climb slowly, the sounds of the forest shifting as we move. Here, the air feels cooler, the vegetation thicker. We pass under the twisted roots of a massive cotton tree that has grown sideways across a sinkhole. Beneath its roots, there's a small opening leading into the darkness. Joey crouches and shines his light inside. The ground is littered with chewed seed husks and dry leaves. Burrow, he says. Not sure if it's active right now, but this is what they look for, shelter, a place where the mongoose can't reach them. The Indian mongoose, introduced to Jamaica in the late 1800s to control rats in sugar plantations, is one of the huisha's main predators. Fast, aggressive, and active during the day, the mongoose hunts young huishas if it finds them outside their burrows. Cats and dogs in rural areas pose another threat. We move on, the forest closing in again. A faint rustle to the right makes Joey stop. We wait, but nothing emerges. Not every sound belongs to the animal we're here to find. Sometimes it's a toad, sometimes a large insect. The huisha remains elusive by design. After another hour, we return to the clearing where we began. Joey notes the location of the earlier sighting in his logbook. Every record counts, he says. If we don't keep track, we can't know how they're doing. As we pack up, the forest feels different. Not quieter, not louder, just more alive. The sighting might have been brief, but it was enough to confirm what science has been saying for decades. The Jamaican huisha is still here, still moving through the shadows, still holding on in the places we've left wild. For Joey, that's reason enough to keep walking these trails at night. Once they're gone, he says. And if we can't protect the only land mammal that's truly ours, what does that say about how we value the rest of this place? The gravel crunches underfoot as you step out of the trees. Behind you, the forest swallows the light again. Somewhere in the darkness, the huisha goes on with its quiet, nightly work. Chapter 2. Once the Island's Companion. Long before roads cut across the island and long before sugar plantations reshaped the hillsides, Jamaica was a place of uninterrupted green. The forests ran from the mountains to the sea, broken only by rivers and narrow beaches. It was in this landscape that the Jamaican huisha lived in great numbers. To the first people who arrived here, the Taino, the animal was neither a rarity nor a mystery. It was a neighbor, and often a meal. The Taino came from the wider Caribbean, bringing with them crops, tools, and knowledge suited to the islands. They knew how to farm cassava, carve canoes, and fish with bone-tipped spears. They also knew how to hunt small animals like the huisha. Archaeological digs in Jamaica have turned up piles of huisha bones mixed with fish remains and shellfish, the debris of old cooking fires. In some caves, these bones date back more than 1,000 years. Dr. Pauline Richards, a Jamaican archaeologist who has spent decades studying pre-Columbian sites, describes the finds as evidence of everyday life. She says, "When we uncover huisha bones alongside grinding stones and pottery, it tells us this was not some rare delicacy. It was part of the regular diet, like how people today might eat chicken or goat. The Taino hunted huishas with patience rather than speed." Oral traditions passed down through the generations speak of silent nighttime trips, when hunters would wait near known feeding grounds or block the entrances of burrows. Sometimes they used small dogs to flush the animals from hiding. Once caught, the huishas were roasted over open fires or stewed with local herbs. In some communities, the huisha was more than food. Its fur could be used to pad sleeping mats or line storage baskets. Its strong front teeth, ever growing, like those of all rodents, could be sharpened and used as small tools for scraping or carving. The animal's presence in both the kitchen and the workshop made it a resource worth knowing. Evidence from other Caribbean islands suggests that huishas were sometimes kept alive for short periods in woven cages, much like livestock. Whether this practice was common in Jamaica is still debated, but the idea fits with the Taino approach to managing food sources. They understood the rhythms of the forest and how to take without exhausting what was there. When European ships arrived in the late 1400s and early 1500s, the Taino way of life began to change rapidly. But at first, the huisha remained abundant. Spanish records from the early colonial period mention conejo, a Spanish word for rabbit, which they sometimes used for huisha. Sailors unfamiliar with the animal would compare it to creatures from home, noting its size and shape rather than its uniqueness. Some of these early accounts describe huisha meat as tender and mild, something that could be eaten without special preparation. In a time when ship provisions often spoiled, a fresh huisha from the island's interior was a welcome addition to the table. Yet these casual mentions in European journals also mark the beginning of a slow shift. As the forest began to be cleared for farming and settlement, the huisha's easy availability worked against it. Animals that once had vast territories were gradually pushed into smaller, fragmented patches of habitat. Still, for generations after the arrival of Europeans, the huisha remained a familiar sight. In rural areas, it was a common part of the diet, especially in seasons when fishing was less fruitful or when crops failed. Farmers and hunters knew where to find it and how to prepare it. In this period, the animal was not seen as exotic or endangered. It was simply part of the fabric of life. Elder stories from parishes like St. Elizabeth and Trelawney describe children being sent into the hills with older relatives to help fetch coney. These were not grand expeditions but small family outings, a way for younger members to learn the lay of the land. A successful trip meant returning with enough meat for a stew shared by several households. The huisha's role in daily life meant it had a place in the island's informal knowledge systems. People knew which fruits it favored, how it moved in different weather, and where its burrows might appear after heavy rains. This kind of observational knowledge often doesn't appear in written records, but it survives in the memory of elders and in fragments of local sayings. One proverb from the Western Hills goes, "Coney no leave him whole if moon too bright." It's a simple reminder that on bright nights, the animal stays hidden longer, wary of predators. Whether meant literally or as a metaphor for human caution, it shows how closely people watched and learned from the huisha's behavior. By the late 1800s, the animal's relationship with humans began to change again. The introduction of new predators, especially the Indian mongoose, altered the balance. The huisha, which had adapted for centuries to local challenges, suddenly faced a fast, aggressive hunter it had never encountered before. Populations started to thin, and in some areas, they disappeared entirely. But before this decline took hold, the huisha had already shaped a place for itself in Jamaican cultural memory. It was an animal that fed families, taught patience to young hunters, and linked the island's present to its distant past. Its story is written not only in the soil and the bones buried there, but in the shared memories of those who once counted it as a neighbor. Today, when you speak to older Jamaicans who grew up in rural parishes, you sometimes hear the same tone in their voices when they mention the huisha. Part nostalgia, part disbelief that it's become so rare. Some recall seeing them scurry at the edges of yam fields or hearing them rustle in the dry leaves on a hot night. For them, the huisha is not an abstract conservation cause, but a creature they knew by sight and sound. In this way, the Jamaican huisha is more than a biological relic. It is a thread that runs through the island's history, from Taino cooking fires to colonial kitchens, from folktales to family recipes. To understand its place in the forest today, we have to understand its place in the hearts and hands of those who came before. The chapter of the huisha as a common island companion has closed, replaced by a story of scarcity and protection. But if you stand in the right forest at the right hour, you might still catch a glimpse of what once was. An animal unhurried, at ease in its home, moving through a world that has known it for centuries. Chapter 3, A Fragile Nightlife. The day belongs to the forest's loudest residents, the chattering birds, the buzzing insects, the occasional rumble of distant thunder. But when night settles in, a quieter rhythm takes over. For the Jamaican huisha, this is the only time to move freely. Every step, every mouthful, every choice it makes in the hours between dusk and dawn can determine whether it survives to see another night. The first sign that a huxia is nearby often comes not from sight but from sound. A crisp snap of a twig, the faint scrape of claws against bark. The animal moves in short, deliberate bursts, stopping often to listen. Even in darkness, it can sense vibrations through the ground, picking up the approach of predators or the sudden shift of a human footstep. Food is at the heart of its nightly activity. The huxia's diet is broad, which has been one of its great strengths. It eats leaves from shrubs, strips bark from young trees, and chews through tough fruit skins to reach the pulp and seeds inside. In dry seasons, it may gnaw on branches for the moisture stored within. Field studies show that a single huxia can cover a surprisingly large area in search of food, sometimes roaming several hundred meters from its burrow before the night ends. Dr. Marlon Shaw, a wildlife biologist based in Kingston, describes the huxia as a forest gardener without knowing it. He explains, they're constantly clipping plants, breaking off twigs, and carrying seeds in their droppings. In a healthy population, they help shape the understory. In this way, their feeding habits benefit the forest itself, even if farmers have not always appreciated their taste for young crops. Predator avoidance shapes nearly every part of a huxia's behavior. Even in areas without mongoose or feral cats, the instinct to pause and listen is strong. If alarmed, the animal will bolt for the nearest shelter, a hollow log, a rock crevice, or a narrow tunnel dug under roots. The entrance to a huxia's burrow is usually small, just wide enough for its body, with sharp turns inside to slow any pursuer. When it comes to reproduction, the huxia's strategy is a mix of caution and investment. Mating can occur at different times of year depending on local conditions, but gestation lasts around 110 days, long for a rodent. Litters are small, usually 2 to 4 young, and the newborns are more developed than most rodents at birth. They have fur, open eyes, and the ability to move within hours. Still, they remain close to the mother for protection and nursing during their first weeks. This slow reproductive rate is one reason the species is vulnerable. A population can't rebound quickly from losses, whether caused by predation, habitat destruction, or hunting. It's not like rats or mice, Dr. Shaw says. If a group of huxia is wiped out in one valley, you can't expect them to repopulate it in a single season. It could take years or never happen at all. To watch a huxia feed is to see a creature built for persistence rather than speed. It will hold a twig or fruit between its front paws, turning it slowly while using sharp incisors to shave off thin strips. Between bites, it will pause, sniff the air, and tilt its head as if measuring the safety of its surroundings. Even the act of drinking, usually from rainwater pooled in leaves or hollows, is done in quick sips before retreating to cover. One night in the hills above Portland Parish, conservation volunteers set up a low blind near a cluster of guava trees. Over several hours, the cameras captured a sequence of visits by different huxias. Some came alone, others in pairs. In one clip, a mother was followed closely by a juvenile, the smaller animal mimicking her movements, even nibbling at the same fruit. These glimpses of family behavior are rare and offer hints of a more social side to the species. While the huxia is generally solitary, pairs may share a den during the breeding season. Communication is subtle, a series of soft grunts, squeaks, or chattering teeth that seem to signal reassurance or mild alarm. Researchers are still piecing together what each sound means, but it's clear the animals are far from silent. Rain changes the night's pattern. A sudden downpour can send a huxia diving for cover, even in the middle of feeding. The wet ground dulls scent trails, making it harder for predators to track them, but it also means leaves and bark are slippery. After heavy rains, they sometimes spend more time close to their burrows, feeding on whatever is within quick reach. Moonlight is another factor. On bright nights, huxias tend to stay under thicker canopy cover, venturing into open ground less often. In deeper darkness, they range more widely, confident that shadows will hide them from sharp-eyed owls or prowling cats. These adjustments may seem minor, but in the life of a small nocturnal mammal, such decisions can mean survival. The fragility of this nightlife becomes clear when you imagine how easily it can be disrupted. A single cleared hillside removes a feeding ground. One new road can cut off a route between burrows and food sources. A stray dog wandering at night can scatter the animals into poorer habitat. Unlike adaptable urban wildlife, the Huaxia depends on the continuity of its forest. Field workers who monitor Huaxia populations often describe the night as a series of calculated risks for the animal. Every step into the open is a gamble. Every pause to chew a leaf is time that could expose it to danger. Yet it continues night after night because the alternative, staying hidden and unfed, is not an option. By dawn, the Huaxia's work is done. It slips back into the darkness of its den, where it will remain until the cycle begins again. The forest grows louder with the calls of birds, the thump of fruit falling to the ground, the rustle of lizards in the leaf litter. To anyone passing by in daylight, the Huaxia might as well not exist. Its world, and the delicate balance that sustains it, belongs to the night. That balance is not just a matter of avoiding predators. It is also about maintaining the quality of the habitat itself. The density of cover, the diversity of plants, the absence of constant human disturbance. These are the conditions that allow a fragile nightlife to continue. Without them, the quiet hours that have belonged to the Huaxia for centuries could vanish in a single generation. Chapter 4: Encounters with Change. The forests that shelter the Jamaican Huaxia today are only fragments of what once covered the island. To imagine the animal's past is to picture a continuous expanse of green, from coastal mangroves to the high peaks, unbroken except for rivers and natural clearings. That world began to change in ways the Huaxia could never adapt to all at once. The first waves of transformation came with the expansion of European settlements in the 1600s. The thickest lowland forests, closest to the sea, were cleared to make way for sugarcane. Hillsides were cut for pasture, and valleys for crops like coffee and pimento. In these early decades, the Huaxia lost not just trees but the complex web of cover, food sources, and safe passageways that linked one feeding area to another. What made this transformation even more severe was its permanence. Land once cleared for plantations rarely returned to forest. Even abandoned fields often became open grassland, unsuitable for a nocturnal animal that depends on dense cover. By the 1800s, the introduction of the Indian mongoose added a new, deadly challenge. The mongoose was brought from India in the 1870s to control rats in cane fields, but it quickly learned to hunt native animals. Unlike many predators, the mongoose is active during the day, the same hours when Huaxias are resting. This made them vulnerable, especially the young and the sick. Oral histories from rural communities tell of the sudden disappearance of Huaxias in areas where they had been common. Farmers who once saw them in yam hills or along stone walls began to notice their absence. The change was not gradual in these places. It happened in the span of a few seasons. But the mongoose was not the only invader. Feral cats, descendants of domestic animals, became skilled night hunters. Dogs roamed freely, especially in remote areas, following their own trails into the bush. The Huaxia, adapted for a life in balance with its native predators, faced an entirely different kind of pursuit. Deforestation continued through the 20th century, though the crops changed. Sugar declined in some regions, replaced by bananas, citrus, and later bauxite mining. Each brought its own form of disruption. Mining in particular carved deep scars into the limestone, leaving behind pits and exposed rock where forest once stood. The Cockpit Country, one of the Huaxia's last refuges, was spared large-scale clearance in part because its terrain is so difficult. Steep-sided hills and sinkholes make mechanized farming nearly impossible. But even here, the edges have been trimmed away. Logging for timber, charcoal production, and small-scale farming have steadily pushed into the margins. Forestry Department Ranger Samuel Bennett recalls patrolling areas that had been untouched for decades, only to find new footpaths leading to freshly cut clearings. "It doesn't take a big road to change things," he says. "Even a small trail can break the connection between feeding and nesting areas. Once you open it up, the dogs and cats can get in easier too." The fragmentation of habitat forces Huaxias into smaller, isolated populations. In theory, an animal can adapt to a smaller range if food is still available. In practice, isolation limits breeding options and increases the risk that a single event, a predator, a fire, a disease, could wipe out an entire group. Climate change adds a slow but steady pressure. Shifts in rainfall patterns affect the plants that Huaxias feed on, and stronger storms can strip entire hillsides of vegetation in a matter of hours. When hurricane winds topple trees, the open ground left behind can take years to recover, years during which the Huaxia must navigate more exposed terrain. In some areas, the change has been invisible to casual observers. A hillside that looks green from a distance may be dominated by invasive plants that offer little food or shelter for wildlife. The composition of the forest matters as much as its size. A walk through parts of Clarendon Parish shows how subtle the loss can be. In the space of a few kilometers, the forest canopy gives way to scattered trees over pasture. The shade is thin, the undergrowth sparse. For a Huesca, this landscape offers no safe place to cross. The animal's instinct is to stick close to cover, but here the cover is broken into pieces. Researchers tracking Huesca movements with GPS collars have documented the reluctance to cross open areas. One collared animal in Trelawney stayed within a single half-hectare patch for weeks, ignoring nearby fruit trees across a 20-meter strip of grass. In this way, even small gaps in the forest become barriers. The cumulative effect of these changes is a narrowing of the Huesca's world. Once it could move across the island's varied landscapes, following seasonal foods and finding new mates. Now its life is often confined to the same ridges and valleys, season after season. The risks are higher, the margins smaller. Still, the Huesca has not disappeared. Its survival so far speaks to a resilience built over millennia. But resilience has limits. When the pressures stack, less food, more predators, fewer safe places, even the hardiest species can tip toward decline. Bennett sums it up simply. The animal is doing its part. It's still here, still trying. It's whether we give it a fair chance to keep going. The story of these encounters with change is not one of a single disaster, but of many small cuts, spread over centuries. None alone was enough to wipe out the Huesca. Together, they have reshaped its future. What remains is a question of how much more change the species can withstand before the balance breaks. Chapter 5, The Quiet Rescue Efforts. Conservation work in Jamaica rarely makes headlines. There are no celebrity campaigns, no massive fundraising concerts. For the Jamaican Huesca, the fight for survival happens in quieter spaces. In forest clearings before dawn, in the back rooms of research stations, in conversations between farmers and local wardens. The first line of defense has been the designation of protected areas. The Cockpit Country, Blue and John Crow Mountains, and parts of the Hell's Higher Hills are now recognized as critical habitats for a variety of species, including the Huesca. These designations limit logging and development, but their boundaries are not walls. People still live on the edges, and in some cases, deep inside the protected zones. Inside the Forestry Department office in Mandeville, a large map on the wall shows a patchwork of green and yellow. Protected lands in green, areas under private ownership in yellow. Conservation Officer Denise Clark runs her finger along a jagged line, separating the two. Animals don't see this border, she says. They move where the food is, where the shelter is. The challenge is keeping those places safe, even outside the green. One approach has been to work directly with landowners. Clark's team visits farmers to explain the Huesca's role in the ecosystem, stressing its seed-dispersing habits and its part in keeping certain plants healthy. They offer advice on reducing crop damage, planting buffer vegetation, fencing small plots, in exchange for commitments not to trap or kill Huescas. The work is slow, built on trust. In some communities, the Huesca is still seen as a pest. Changing that perception requires more than a single meeting. Clark tells the story of a farmer in Saint, and who reluctantly agreed to leave a patch of bushland untouched after years of cutting it back. He thought nothing lived there that mattered, she says. 6 months later, he told me he saw one of the big rats at night and decided maybe it was worth keeping. Beyond outreach, there are the technical measures. Motion-triggered cameras are deployed in known Huesca areas, collecting data on population size and movement patterns. This information helps identify corridors between habitats, strips of forest or hedgerow that allow animals to travel between larger blocks of woodland. Maintaining these corridors can be the difference between isolated, vulnerable populations and a healthy, connected network. In the Blue Mountains, a small captive breeding program has been underway for several years. The facility is modest, a set of outdoor enclosures with secure burrows and climbing structures. Here, Huescas are paired carefully to maintain genetic diversity. The goal is not to keep them in captivity permanently, but to strengthen numbers for eventual release into secure wild sites. Wildlife technician Omar Johnson oversees daily care. They're shy at first, he says, but once they get used to you, they'll take food from your hand. We give them the same plants they'd find outside so they don't lose the instinct to feed naturally. He points to a young Huchsia climbing over a branch in its enclosure. That one was born here last year. It's almost ready for release. Release is never a simple matter. The site must have enough food and shelter, minimal predator presence, and a buffer from heavy human activity. Even then, released animals need monitoring. Tiny radio collars, designed to fall off after a few months, allow the team to track survival rates and movements. The Hellshire Hills, west of Kingston, present a different conservation model. Here, the terrain is harsh, dry limestone forest with twisted shrubs and sharp rock underfoot. Few people live in the core area, and its inaccessibility has shielded it from large-scale development. Surveys in recent years have found Huchsia signs in parts of Hellshire, suggesting a small but persistent population. Efforts here focus less on direct management and more on keeping the area undisturbed. Community involvement is a thread running through all of these efforts. In Trelawney, a group of local youth known as Huchsia Watch conducts monthly night walks, recording sightings, and reporting illegal hunting. Their equipment is basic: flashlights, notebooks, a GPS app on a few smartphones. But their coverage reaches areas too small for government patrols to monitor regularly. School programs have also played a role in shifting attitudes. Workshops bring students into nearby forests to learn about native species, including the Huchsia. Seeing the animal, or even just its tracks, can transform it from an abstract concept into something worth protecting. Funding remains a constant challenge. Grants from international conservation organizations help purchase equipment and pay for surveys, but these funds are often project-specific and time-limited. When a grant cycle ends, maintaining momentum can be difficult. Despite the challenges, there have been small successes. In some monitored sites, camera traps have recorded an increase in Huchsia activity over a 5-year span. Whether this reflects actual population growth or simply better detection is still under study, but it is enough to encourage those involved. For Clark, Johnson, and others in the field, the measure of success is not only in numbers but in relationships. Each farmer who chooses to keep a patch of bush intact, each student who comes away from a field trip talking about the Huchsia, is part of the slow work of conservation. This is not a rescue that will be won with a single intervention. It will take decades of steady effort, often unnoticed by the wider public. The Huchsia's survival depends on people who are willing to work in that quiet space, walking the same trails month after month, checking the same burrows, and keeping the conversation alive in the communities that share the land. In the end, the quiet rescue efforts are not just about saving one species. They are about keeping a piece of Jamaica's natural heritage intact, ensuring that future generations will inherit more than stories and old bones. In the stillness of the forest at night, when a Huchsia steps out from the shadows to feed, the reward for that work becomes clear. Chapter 6, A Symbol in Folklore and Memory. In Jamaica's rural hills, where evenings still stretch long after the sun sinks and the only light comes from kerosene lamps or the moon, stories travel as easily as the wind. They pass from elder to child, neighbor to neighbor, in a mix of memory, humor, and quiet lessons. Among these stories, the Jamaican Huchsia, or Coney, appears less as a rare scientific curiosity and more as a familiar character, shaped by the teller's own history. The Huchsia's presence in folklore is not loud or central like Anansi the spider or the rolling calf of Jamaican ghost tales. Instead, it slips into the background, often as a symbol of caution, patience, or survival. In some parishes, people recall hearing from their grandparents that the Coney know when to keep still and when to run, a phrase meant as advice for navigating trouble in life. Elder storyteller Miriam James from Manchester Parish remembers the Huchsia as the little watchman of the bush. Sitting on her veranda, she leans forward to explain. Them say Coney can hear a stick break a mile away. If you rushing through life, you miss the danger. Coney wait and listen before it move. That's how him live long. Her words are not about wildlife biology but about a way of being, alert, measured, and deliberate. Other tales place the Huchsia in more playful roles. In one old children's rhyme from St. Elizabeth, the Coney outsmarts a farmer's dog by hiding in a hollow breadfruit log until nightfall, then slipping away while the dog sleeps. The lesson is clear: brains over brawn, patience over panic. In some fishing villages along the south coast, older residents recall hearing that a huisha seen at dusk was a sign of good luck. Not for fishing, but for crops. The belief was that if the coney had enough to eat and was bold enough to move early, the land must be fertile that season. Whether anyone truly believed it or simply enjoyed the thought, the idea wove the animal into the rhythms of planting and harvest. The huisha's quiet, mostly unseen nature also made it a symbol of the unseen work that keeps life moving. In folk sayings, working like the coney meant doing steady, important work without calling attention to yourself. The image was of the animal nibbling leaves and carrying seeds in the dark, shaping the forest while most people slept. Not all the stories are flattering. In some communities, especially where huishas once raided yam hills or banana plants, it became the mischievous thief of the bush. Children were warned that coney will tech what you don't watch. The saying served both as a lesson in guarding your possessions and as a light-hearted jab at forgetfulness. Local art has preserved the huisha in subtle ways. In some rural wood carvings sold at roadside stands in Trelawney and St. Mary, you might find a small, rounded figure with short ears and a slightly hunched back. Not labeled, not immediately obvious, but a nod to the coney. The carvers, often working from memory, included alongside birds, fish, and other familiar creatures. In Jamaican proverbs, the huisha sometimes stands in for the idea of knowing your limits. Coney no jump where him tail can't follow warns against starting something you can't finish. Here, the animal's cautious movements through its forest home are transformed into human wisdom about planning and restraint. Even in songs, though rare, the huisha's name surfaces. Old Mento tunes, the kind played at village gatherings in the mid-20th century, occasionally reference coney in the bush as a playful aside, a stand-in for someone keeping out of sight or staying out of trouble. Folklore doesn't measure accuracy the way science does. The huisha of stories is sometimes bigger than life, sometimes cleverer than nature allows, sometimes behaving more like a human than a rodent. But these tales have kept its image alive in a way that field guides and research papers never could. For many Jamaicans under 40, especially those in urban areas, the huisha is not part of daily awareness. They might have heard the name from a grandparent or seen a carved version at a craft market, but the living animal is distant. In this sense, folklore becomes the bridge, a way of knowing the huisha without ever seeing it. When elders speak of it, their voices often carry the tone of something precious but slipping away. They remember nights when you could hear one moving in the bush behind a yard, or mornings when tracks showed where it had passed. These memories give the animal a place in personal history, even as its numbers have declined. This cultural memory matters for conservation. An animal that exists only in books can feel like a stranger. One that lives in your family's stories feels worth protecting. Efforts to save the huisha are stronger when they draw on this shared history, connecting scientific urgency with the quieter pull of heritage. In a way, the huisha's place in folklore mirrors its life in the wild. Quiet, persistent, often overlooked, but enduring in the spaces where it has always belonged. It may no longer be the common companion it once was, but in the words, songs, and carvings that carry its image forward, it remains part of Jamaica's living story. Chapter 7. What We Stand to Lose. The Jamaican huisha may not roar like a lion or dazzle with bright feathers, but the role it plays in the forest is no less important. To lose it would mean more than the disappearance of a single species. It would mean unraveling a set of quiet relationships that have been in place for thousands of years. Links between plants, soil, and other animals that most of us never notice. One of the huisha's most valuable roles is as a seed disperser. In feeding on fruits, it swallows seeds that later pass through its digestive system and are deposited far from the parent plant. The process doesn't just spread plants. It gives seedlings a better chance at survival by moving them away from the shade and competition of the parent tree. Some seeds may even germinate better after passing through the gut of an animal like the huisha, where the tough outer coating is softened. Forests rely on a diversity of seed dispersers, from birds to bats to mammals. Each fills a slightly different niche. Birds may carry seeds long distances in flight. Bats often drop seeds under roost trees. The huisha, moving slowly across the forest floor, tends to place seeds in small, scattered patches of cleared ground, a perfect setting for some understory plants. Remove the huisha, and those plants may find fewer opportunities to establish. The animal's habit of gnawing bark and clipping stems also shapes the forest in subtle ways. By feeding on young shoots, it can slow the growth of certain plants, giving others a chance to compete for light and space. In places where Huchia populations have declined sharply, researchers have noticed a shift in the understory composition. Some fast-growing shrubs dominate while other, slower species fade. Over time, these changes ripple upward, affecting insects, birds, and even the way rainwater moves through the soil. Predators also feel the loss. The Huchia is part of the diet of several native birds of prey, including the barn owl and the red-tailed hawk. While these predators can switch to other food sources, the disappearance of a regular prey item can alter their hunting ranges and breeding success. For the forest itself, the Huchia's absence would mean one less player in the complex game of regeneration. A single animal might not seem like much, but multiply its nightly movements over years, and its impact is clear. Each clipped twig, each dropped seed, each tunnel dug under roots is part of an ongoing exchange between species. Beyond ecology, there is the cultural cost. As explored in the previous chapter, the Huchia carries centuries of human connection, in proverbs, stories, and memories. Losing it would sever that thread. You can still tell the stories, but without the living animal, they become something different. Memories of a world that no longer exists. This is not an abstract scenario. Caribbean history is full of examples of species disappearing quietly, with little fanfare. The Jamaican rice rat, once common in wetlands, is gone. So is the Caribbean monk seal. In each case, there were signs, shrinking ranges, fewer sightings. But by the time concern grew loud enough, the decline had gone too far to reverse. The Huchia is not yet at that point. Populations survive in several pockets of forest, and in some places they appear stable. But the pressures are real: habitat loss, predators, slow reproduction. Conservationists know that waiting until the species is critically endangered would mean fighting uphill with limited options. The disappearance of the Huchia would also be a warning about the fragility of island ecosystems. Jamaica's native mammals are already few in number. The Huchia is the only one left. If it goes, there will be no native land mammal at all. That would place Jamaica among the growing list of islands where entire branches of the native animal tree have been cut off. For younger generations, the loss would be felt in absence rather than memory. They would grow up with pictures in books instead of sightings in the wild. The idea of the Huchia as a living neighbor would fade, replaced by the notion of it as something that used to be here. Some might argue that the loss of a small, shy rodent is not the same as losing a large predator or a species with clear economic value. But this way of thinking misses the deeper truth. Ecosystems are built from countless small parts, many of which we barely understand. Remove enough of them, and the whole structure weakens. In talking with conservationist Denise Clark, she put it plainly: when we save the Huchia, we're not just saving one animal. We're keeping the forest itself healthy. And when the forest is healthy, we all benefit, whether we realize it or not. What we stand to lose, then, is not just a species. It's a set of services we didn't have to pay for: seed dispersal, vegetation management, a stable food web. It's also a living link to the island's deep past and a piece of cultural identity that can't be replaced once it's gone. There is still time, but the window is not endless. The choice now is whether to treat the Huchia as a symbol worth keeping in the forest, not just in memory, or to let it join the long list of things that were once part of Jamaica but are no longer. Chapter 8. Hope for the Night Wanderer. Dawn in the cockpit country is a slow unveiling. First, the outline of the limestone hills emerges against a paling sky. Then, the mist begins to lift from the sinkholes and valleys, revealing the dense tangle of vegetation below. Somewhere in that tangle, a Huchia curls in its burrow, the night's foraging done. It will not stir again until the light fades. The quiet presence of this animal is easy to miss. Its survival depends on it being overlooked. Yet, paradoxically, its future depends on being noticed by the scientists who track its numbers, by the communities who share its habitat, and by the broader public who might never see one in the wild, but can still play a role in protecting it. Hope for the Jamaican Huchia lies in a combination of practical action and cultural reconnection. Conservationists often talk about hard and soft measures. The hard measures are the tangible protections: setting aside land, controlling predators, and ensuring safe corridors between forest patches. The soft measures are the less visible but equally vital changes: shifting public perception, rekindling cultural awareness, and making the Huisha part of Jamaica's living identity again. In the past decade, there has been progress on both fronts. Habitat mapping has become more detailed, identifying not only where Huishas live, but where they might be able to expand if given the chance. This allows conservation groups to prioritize specific areas for protection or restoration. Planting native trees in degraded patches, for example, can reconnect two isolated populations. Predator control remains difficult, but not impossible. In some reserves, focused efforts to reduce feral cat and mongoose numbers have led to measurable increases in native wildlife sightings. These programs are expensive and labor-intensive, but they demonstrate that with consistent effort, the balance can be nudged back in the Huisha's favor. Community engagement is showing results as well. In Trelawney, the Huisha Watch youth group has expanded into neighboring parishes, training new volunteers to conduct night surveys. What began as a handful of young people curious about their local wildlife has grown into a network sharing data with the forestry department. Their work doesn't just generate information. It fosters a sense of ownership over the animal's future. Education programs in rural schools are also making an impact. Children who learn about the Huisha in class are more likely to share that knowledge at home. In some cases, this has led to families reconsidering whether to clear certain patches of forest or to set dogs loose at night. These are small decisions, but multiplied across communities, they can create safer spaces for wildlife. International partnerships have brought new resources. Grants from regional conservation networks have funded more camera traps, GPS tracking equipment, and training for field workers. Visiting researchers from other Caribbean islands, where related Huisha species still survive, have shared insights into breeding programs and habitat management. Perhaps most importantly, the Huisha is slowly becoming a symbol of something larger. Conservation campaigns have begun using its image alongside more familiar Jamaican wildlife, like the Dr. Bird and the crocodile, placing it within the narrative of national heritage. Posters in community centers show a Huisha peeking from behind a rock with the words, "Our only native mammal, keep it wild." The road ahead is not without obstacles. Habitat loss has not stopped. Development pressures remain strong, and predator control is an ongoing battle. But the presence of active, coordinated efforts changes the equation. The Huisha's situation is no longer one of unnoticed decline. It is now a recognized challenge with a growing number of people working toward a solution. There is a kind of hope that comes from numbers on a chart. Population counts ticking upward, new habitats mapped, threats reduced. But there is another kind of hope, less quantifiable, that comes from seeing the animal's story resonate with people. When an elder tells a child about hearing a Huisha rustle in the bush decades ago, and that child sees the same animal in a school presentation, a bridge is built between past and present. In the long run, that connection may prove as important as any fence or reserve. Conservation depends on more than biology. It depends on the will to care. The Huisha's endurance so far has been a matter of adaptation and luck. Its endurance into the future will depend on whether we choose to make space for it. In the forest, in our laws, and in our collective imagination. One evening, not long ago, a motion-activated camera in the Blue Mountains captured an image of a Huisha carrying a sprig of leaves in its mouth, its eyes bright in the infrared light. It was a simple moment, an animal returning to its shelter with food. But to the researchers who retrieved the footage, it was a sign that life goes on, that the quiet work of survival continues. That ultimately is the hope for the night wanderer. That the spaces it needs will remain, that the dangers will be kept at bay, and that it will go on doing what it has always done, moving through the shadows, feeding in the dark, leaving behind the seeds of tomorrow's forest. The sun is high now over Cockpit Country, and the hills are alive with birdsong. The Huisha sleeps, unseen. Somewhere, a young person walks a forest trail for the first time, scanning the ground for signs, hoping for a glimpse. The story is not finished. There is still time to write the next chapter, not in memory, but in the living green of the island itself.